Fastneck.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes.
Good morning. My name is Bob Tarun. I was counsel for Vincent Malenga at the trial, and I am now counsel for him on appeal. I best know how unfair count four was to defend at trial. 58 months after an alleged conspiracy to defeat or impede the IRS, Vincent Malenga, an economist, was charged here in Chicago in a five-count indictment returned January 23, 2001. I received the indictment. I immediately went to my office, went to a whiteboard, and wrote down five counts. Count one is a conspiracy to evade the IRS. I understood that count. I understood the pleading. Count two was a tax evasion account against Newell, the co-conspirator, and cooperator with the government. I thought the count was weak factually since it wasn't my client's return, but I understood the count. Count three was tax evasion by my client for the calendar year 1994. I fully understood that count and what I had to defend. Count four perplexed me that day. I could not understand how my client in New York, who did not appear before a grand jury in Chicago, who did not submit any false document to a grand jury in Chicago, who had nothing to do with this grand jury in Chicago, who was interviewed the date this grand jury allegedly convened, although the government never put any evidence into the record of that. I had no idea how this man obstructed a grand jury, endeavored to impede or corruptly endeavored to impede the grand jury in Chicago. Count five on the whiteboard was the co-defendant John Fosnack's false representation. That was not my problem. I had four counts that I had to defend. I filed a motion for a bill of particulars. I didn't file a boilerplate canned motion for a bill of particulars. I filed a very specific bill of particulars on count four because I was lost on how to defend my client. And in the brief that I submitted to this court at page six, I reincorporate and restate exactly what my motion said. This is not an appellate issue that was created after the trial was over and you look through the transcript. At the very beginning of this trial and pleading by the government, I had a serious problem on how to defend a grand jury obstruction count that my client did nothing to obstruct any grand jury proceeding.
But could I just say that looking at this indictment, you can see from count four the time span, right? From
yes.
Approximately March 26th, you can see the particular grand jury. And when you go back, I'm going to say roughly starting at paragraph 14 in the original part, you see what things the government is alleging from that time period. And what I want to do is separate the question whether those things amount to a 1503 violation.
Okay.
That's your merits argument, your insufficiency argument, from the question whether you knew what they were claiming was the 1503 violation. And I'm having trouble seeing how, in the final analysis, you didn't know what this case was about. You did know what they were saying, and you attacked their showing on specific intent. You attacked their showing on his knowledge of whether the grand jury was there. Strikes me you did exactly what you would want to do. So I'm not sure at this stage of the game whether, even if it was a mistake for the district judge to refuse your bill of particulars, what difference it makes. Because this case seems to me to boil down entirely to your sufficiency of the evidence argument, your Aguilar argument, and that, I think, is what it all sort of collapses into. That's what you care about, right? I mean, the bill of particulars.
Your Honor,
they weren't introducing evidence beyond this that was bagging you.
The government put on no evidence of a grand jury. I mean, they didn't call a witness to say the grand jury met this date. We subpoenaed these witnesses.
That's
we did anything.
Point. They weren't putting on evidence that you didn't expect. They didn't suddenly come in with a whole different story that they hadn't disclosed here. They came in with a story that you argue was just didn't add up to 1503 liability, right?
Judge, their whole case was defeating the IRS. And if you look at the evidence, that's what our clients who were being taped. Now, let me
No, I understand, but I'm just saying, focusing on the... I just want to get the bill of particulars off the table because I would really like to hear what you have to say on your sufficiency of the evidence point.
They're related, though, Judge.
I understand they're sort of related, but unless you say they came in and after this indictment, they tried to show... You know, that he was bribing all the witnesses that went before the grand jury, and you had never been told anything about that, or whatever. All sorts of things didn't happen like that.
But the point, Judge, is they tried a case, and they told this judge they were going to try a case on obstructing an IRS investigation. And the entire proof, if you look at it, it's talking about the IRS getting lawyers, tax attorneys, for these defendants to put together documents so that they can deal with the IRS.
But could I ask you, I know, for instance, in the antitrust division, that there are criminal and civil investigations, and they run grand juries, you know, and if it's a criminal investigation, the same people you might be talking to one day on a merger and a CID might the next day be doing a criminal investigation with the grand jury. And the IRS, similarly, sometimes proceeds criminally. So I'm not positive that there's such a dichotomy between an IRS investigation and a grand jury criminal
Judge,
investigation.
Judge, if they sent an FBI agent out there, I would agree with you 100%. But you've got an accountant in John Fosnack who is viewing towards settling this, and he says that on the tape. We can settle this, okay? My client isn't even a CPA. And you look at Aguilar and you look at Schwartz, there they said a federal judge and trained law enforcement agents aren't supposed to connect those investigations to a grand jury. And now I think you're suggesting that my client is a layman. It's supposed to go through this mental, okay, let's see, it's IRS, it could be civil, it could be criminal, let me think that through how this really, you know.
Now, your argument is that although Mr. Fosnack got the grand jury subpoena, Mr. Malanga never did?
There's no evidence that Vincent Malanga ever received any grand jury subpoena, and when he's interviewed on March 26 in New York, they never brought out any grand jury. The agents didn't say anything about that. They said they were from the IRS. And this layman isn't going to put, you know, that in Chicago there is a grand jury convening on that very date. In fact, the interview starts at about 8:30 that morning in New York, and I submit to you that no grand jury in this district, which starts at 10 in the morning, had even convened at that time. Mm-hmm. And this is a case where I think if you go through this evidence and you listen to the tapes where it's Newell asking questions working for the government, and he tapes 50 times, and he's working, he's the handmaiden of the IRS at this point. If they had fought back at that time...
Well, how many of these tapes were made before he started cooperating? He started doing it with the...
Yeah, I think there are about
lawyers behalf.
Right. I think there are about 5 or 6, but then there are about 40 with the IRS judge.
Okay.
And it goes on for 6 weeks. And if back at that point, the U.S. Attorney's Office thought, I've been on trial in Kentucky and I got this ice storm down there that just nailed me, so. I apologize.
Good thing your red light is on.
Oh, my God.
Go ahead.
In any event, I just lost where I was. 40 tapes, okay. If the government had thought back at that time that he was obstructing a grand jury investigation, they've got Newell, their handmaiden, who's doing 40 tapes. You have the witness say, you have Newell, who's cooperating, say, I'm going into the grand jury Tuesday. Should I take these documents and lie, or I'm going to give them this story in the grand jury? I mean, they could have orchestrated this if they ever thought that that was what was going on here. But there's none of that kind of testimony. And this case was just... it frankly was an afterthought. It's the kind of indictment you put together 4 years later, 5 years later. It's a toss-in count, and they didn't prove it up at trial. They were focused on impeding the IRS. That's what we defended, and it just this is a case where if they had cured, if they'd known what their theory was, they could have cured it in a minute in the response to the bill of particulars. And this court, the trial court, was led to believe that this case is centered on a single act, the alleged attempt to evade paying taxes on income generated from payment of an incentive fee by funneling the money through an offshore bank account. That's what they told Judge Manning it was, that's what she ruled in her pretrial motion, and that's what they put on as a case. They didn't put on obstruction of a grand jury. They didn't put on agents to say, a grand jury convened, we gave out subpoenas, they obstructed these witnesses. This was an afterthought, and it invited confusion by the jury. That's what I warned of when I filed my bill of particulars, and that's exactly what happened. It's the lone count on which this defendant was convicted, and, you know, they could have cured it. They didn't. They filed a canned response, and I didn't file a boilerplate bill of particulars. I said exactly what I needed, and I was unable to defend, and I think the evidence that came in this case focused on obstruction of an IRS investigation. That's what the defendants are talking about, and after 5 weeks of this, my client says on tape, I mean, why are we gathering invoices? Why do we need these documents? I mean, if we made a mistake, let's take care of it and pay them back. I mean, here is a man who's got this cooperator who's asking all sorts of things, but he never submits a document, creates a document, or submits any document to any grand jury. And respectfully, he did not have an opportunity. He wasn't adequately told on count four of what he had to defend, and the jury was confused. It came back. It was invited to look at a conspiracy count that overlapped in time, and he frankly just did not get fair consideration on count four.
It's
that simple. One other thing I might add is I had the burden in the cross-examination of the agent of putting in the evidence that the grand jury did not hear a single witness between those dates. And I should have no burden in a criminal case, but I had to take on the IRS agent and elicit that proof. And I'm the defendant without any burden.
Thank
that's
you,
what
Mr.
I
Jones.
Have to do.
Over.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Linda Coverly, and I represent defendant John Fosnacht. Our client fell prey to the same difficulties and the same injustices at the trial as Mr. Malanga. I'd like to focus on the sufficiency of the evidence point, and I'd like to focus specifically on Aguilar. In Aguilar, a defendant, a federal judge, lied to an FBI agent, knowing that a grand jury had convened and was investigating the very issue that was the subject of that conversation. The Supreme Court held that that was not sufficient to establish guilt under Section 1503. In order to get around the Aguilar case, the government here has suggested, without proving, that the IRS investigation in this case was somehow inextricably intertwined with the grand jury investigation, and that the defendants should have known that, realized it, and intended that their efforts to allegedly impede the IRS would have the necessary and probable effect of impeding the grand jury. That proof is simply not there in this case.
Were the words grand jury ever disclosed in any of the tape conversations, the term grand jury?
It appears, but not in the connection that the government suggests. There is no evidence that anyone intended Ed Burke, for example, the witness in Switzerland who was a great focus of the government.
Mysterious Mr. Burke.
Exactly. There's no evidence that anyone knew or thought or suggested that he might testify to the grand jury. There's no evidence that any document was prepared with the intention that it be provided to the grand jury. In fact, the documents that were created in this case, to the extent that any were created in the charged period, were created at the suggestion of Mr. Newell, who was working for the government at the time, and they were created for the purpose, according to Mr. Newell, of providing them to his tax advisors. You see, from the defendant's perspective, this was a tax matter. This was a tax case from the beginning. The defendants were focused...
Well, that's why I asked the question about whether grand jury, the idea of grand jury ever came up in any of the recorded conversations.
Your Honor, I believe that there was mention of the fact that at some point John Fosnacht would be testifying before the grand jury, that he had received a subpoena. He mentioned that he had received a subpoena for documents. That's the only kind of reference we have. We never have reference to the fact that the grand jury needs to be stopped. We need to persuade the grand jury.
And do we have any evidence that the subpoena for documents then elicited submission of the false documents?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. There's no evidence that any false document was ever produced to the IRS, was ever provided to someone whom the defendants believed would testify to the IRS. There's no evidence that any false information was given or any false suggestion was given to someone who was going to testify before the grand jury. This is simply a case, at most here, the government's evidence suggests that there was a scheme to evade the IRS. That's it. That's why the government is trying to create this link between the IRS investigation and the grand jury, and it simply is not proven. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. So.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Deborah Bonamici, and I represent the United States in this matter. Your Honors, as Judge Wood noticed, this case really does boil down to a sufficiency of the evidence case, question. The indictment contained allegations concerning all of the necessary elements, as well as factual allegations related to conduct engaged in after the inception of the grand jury investigation.
But and you know what the indictment doesn't say is how any of this conduct hooks up with the grand jury. I've looked at it pretty carefully, and I have to say, if the Supreme Court thought the evidence in Aguilar, after a jury convicted Judge Aguilar, was insufficient to support that conviction, it has told us that the threshold for supporting a conviction under 1505, under 1503, is a high threshold, and I'm quite troubled at the holes in the government's proof. Whether these people were doing things or having conversations is one thing. Whether you've proven specific intent to interfere, as you undertook to do in this indictment, with federal grand jury investigation number 96GJ258, those are two really different things. And I thought your brief was a little... I don't know what an Edmund is. Do you know what an Edmund is?
Your Honor, that was a... if you're referring to the page that I noticed, there's two pages of the typographical error.
Where you use the word Edmund instead
yes,
of
and
signature?
I don't, yes, and that's page 8.
And page 9.
That's correct. And its signature is what that word is supposed to mean. And for the life of me, I can't understand what happened with the word processor on that. But I noticed it as well.
But anyway, I mean, you say that there is evidence linking these things up, and you have no citations in your brief to what that evidence is. And you need to tell us how the jury on the 1503 point could have gotten from the indictment to the conviction.
Well, Your Honor, I agree with, first of all, your initial comment that you do need to refrain from collapsing the issue of what the indictment alleged on one hand and the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence on the other hand, because those really are two different matters to which two different standards of review apply, and they really relate to two different aspects. But focusing on the more important issue of the sufficiency of the evidence, in fact, there are repeated references to grand jury testimony by Mr. Fosnock in the recorded conversations, including references to that grand jury testimony prior to the time that Mr. Newell began cooperating with the government.
But for example, in your brief, this is in the summary section, I'm looking for the other part, because you say on page 24, the IRS was integrally involved in the grand jury proceeding and defendants knew it. I don't see that. I don't see how they knew that the IRS was working hand in hand with the grand jury.
Well, Your Honor, it's very important to pay careful attention, especially to the transcripts of the recorded conversations, which we did supplement the record with and are available for your review.
Right.
The conversations make clear time and time again that the topic or the concept that Fasnacht had been subpoenaed to not only provide documents but also to testify before the grand jury, that he had been scheduled to testify before the grand jury. Later there's a discussion about how his scheduled testimony had been postponed. Repeatedly, time and time again, there's conversations about Fasnacht's testimony before the grand jury that indicate, in a context that indicates that defendants believed that that testimony was, in essence, a deadline for the completion of the false documents that they also discussed in the same conversation. Now, with respect to the false documents...
But how do we know that there... I mean, again, maybe this is about how much circumstantial evidence you can use, but I don't... those conversations appear pretty exploratory, and whether they intended the grand jury itself, as opposed to the IRS, to be misled, is something you had to prove. You had to take it all the way into the grand jury room, not just the IRS.
And, Your Honor, indeed, those conversations made it very clear that this was definitely headed toward the grand jury. And let me explain why.
What did they say? Give me a quote from a transcript.
Well, they repeatedly quote on the taped conversation on April 2nd, 1996. Actually, there's two conversations on April 2nd. First, Malanga and Newell discussed various issues related to the potential problems that they were facing. But they specifically, then Malanga indicated that he had spoken with Fasnacht and that Fasnacht planned to call Switzerland, who we all know it was Edmund Burke, the following day. Malanga confirmed that Newell was going to should stick with the story. They all agreed, each one of them agreed to stick with the finder's fee story that admittedly they had concocted prior to the inception of the grand jury investigation. But what
so
you
that,
see
what are we supposed to get from this April 2nd conversation, and how do we know it's about the grand jury?
The conversation then continues to discuss the subpoena that Fasnacht had informed Newell that he had received a grand jury subpoena, but that he had not yet turned over documents that had been requested. Also, that he was supposed to testify. Then they discussed the possibility of calling Mr. Fasnacht, and in fact, Mr. Newell does call Mr. Fasnacht at Mr. Malanga's direction or suggestion. And during that conversation, Fasnacht and Newell discuss, and Fasnacht, in fact, speculates as to the focus of the grand jury's investigation, and they conclude that the focus is the finder's fee,
There's a conversation on the tape that discusses the focus of the grand jury investigation.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. And this, you would look at the conversation between Fasnacht
and Newell. You're talking about all the stuff on page 12 and 13 of your brief.
That's correct. Fasnacht says, stick with the story. They agree to stick with the story. And then Fasnacht indicates, you remember, I previously given you drafts of that finder's fee. And by that, in that conversation, you see that the document, that is the specific document, the finder's fee agreement, was still in a state of flux, that they still not determined who was going to be the recipient of the finder's fee, Edmund Burke or Edmund Burke's company.
Now, do you think it's enough to sustain 1503 liability if not a single word of this ever reaches the grand jury?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The law is absolutely clear that the defendants do not have to succeed in obstructing the grand jury. They need to endeavor to obstruct the grand jury, and that's exactly what they did in this case.
So they sit around and concoct a story.
They eventually decide
not to use it, or it goes, or they prepare these documents for their tax accountants or whatever. That's enough for liability, in your view?
Well, I disagree. That the idea is that they prepare these documents solely for their tax accountants. Here's what's going on: these men know that not only is the IRS looking at them, but they are under criminal investigation. There's a conversation where Mr. Fasnacht.
I take it you're just flatly in disagreement with what Mr. Malanga's lawyer has said.
Absolutely, absolutely, because there's no way that you can practically read the conversations, the recorded conversations, and come up with that description of what was going on. There's absolutely no way you can read that. And if you look at the short appendix provided by the defendants themselves. In fact, in contrast to the Aguilar case, there was evidence that the criminal IRS investigator who was conducting the investigation was the case agent and presented evidence and worked on behalf of the grand jury.
That's Ms. Tice, right?
That's Ms. Tice, that's correct. And that's on page 100 of the short appendix. There was evidence that that indeed was the case, and the evidence clearly established through the recorded conversations that these things were together, not only in reality, but also in the defendant's mind. And think about it from a practical perspective. What good would it have ever done the defendants to have obstructed the IRS and then later get indicted by the grand jury because they failed to obstruct the grand jury as well? I mean, these things are
If we looked at your closing argument in this case, would you be pinpointing those factors which relate to this count and obstructing the grand jury?
Well, it would not have been my closing argument,
well,
Your Honor, because
the government
I did not.
I'm referring to.
I don't recall every detail of the closing argument. I assume that they would be included, but I would urge Your Honors, instead of looking at the arguments of counsel in this case, to rather look at the evidence itself and focus.
But assuming the argument of the counsel will pinpoint the evidence that you suggest applies to this count.
Well, you would assume so, but the most important fact, or the question is presented before you. Right. And I agree. But the question, and it's just that I can't call to mind the details of the argument.
I understand that you weren't counsel, but that may be a point that we can look at and see what the arguments, your arguments, and what the defense counsel.
Well, the question before Your Honor is whether the jury could reasonably conclude, based on the evidence, that the actions of the defendant demonstrated an intent to obstruct both the grand jury investigation and the IRS. It was the government's theory, as expressed in the indictment and through the evidence, that the defendants intended and attempted to obstruct both.
Let me ask you, of course, kind of an offshoot of what Judge Kaney just asked you. I think all of us have seen cases where there are multi-count indictments. This is one of them, where some of the counts look like that's what this case is really about. And then there's a couple of counts in there that are pretty minor, throwaway counts or whatever you want to say. This looks like it was tried and presented as a tax case, and that's what everybody was focusing on, and that this, I'm just wondering if when the jury verdict is read in court, does the prosecutor sit there and say, holy smokes, they gave these guys a pass on the tax counts and convicted them on?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not, Your Honor. We reject that description of these events completely. What this case began as an IRS criminal investigation, and when Don Newell came in and began cooperating, he advised the authorities that not only had the defendants attempted to obstruct the IRS with respect to the $1.35 million fee that they had concealed in the Bermuda Company, but in addition, they were currently engaged in a conspiracy to an endeavor to obstruct the grand jury investigation as we speak, was basically what he conveyed to them. And it was at that point that the investigation expanded to include the obstructive conduct that related to the grand jury investigation. And it's completely false to suggest that that was not a substantial piece of this prosecution, because it absolutely was. It was a subsequent piece. It wasn't the way that the investigation, the prosecution began, but it was definitely a fundamental piece of it. And you know what? It was a fundamental motive of the defendants to obstruct the grand jury investigation, and you can see that as you read the taped conversations. You see it's all one thing. And these documents were prepared and discussed and refined, and the finder's fee story was discussed and refined, and problems with the story were needed to be ironed out, and it all relates to what was going to be presented. And one way that you can tell that that was the case is that there was a conversation specifically about whether they could get away with turning over these documents at this late stage after they had already responded to the grand jury subpoena by saying that they had submitted everything they had. That one point is very, 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 very telling. The defendants were working with their lawyers and their tax accountants to present the best.
We will find, looking at these tapes, that they're wondering whether this created documents can be submitted at this late date to the grand jury.
you will find absolutely that they state specifically whether they could whether this would raise suspicions given the fact that they had already responded by saying that they'd given all the documents that they had. I mean, it's clear that what they were working on was putting together the best presentation they could to obstruct both. And the final point that I would make, Your Honor, is this wasn't an effort to convince the authorities that their conduct had been legal. This was an effort to convince the authorities that things had happened when they had not happened. Everyone acknowledges that this entire story was a complete fabrication and that all of the various details concerning the story were fabrications as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counselor. How much time? You have 1 minute, but I'll give you a couple minutes.
Thank you. Once again, in order to prove its central issue in this case, the government is making vague references to the grand jury in the context of these recordings.
Very specific in the last one, though.
There are a couple of issues that I'd like to respond to, and that's the first one. There was a point in the recordings where Mr. Malanga expressed concern that a particular document didn't exist before, hadn't been produced to the grand jury, and wouldn't it create suspicion if it existed now? There's no mention in that connection that this document would now be provided to the grand jury. The question is simply, we told the grand jury that we didn't have any responsive documents. Now we have this document. Doesn't that look suspicious? Maybe it looks suspicious for tax advisors, because that, after all, was who these documents were going to. Maybe it would look suspicious to the IRS, because they were the ones who were investigating everything. There is no discussion about the grand jury in that connection. Moreover, immediately after the portion of the trial transcript that discusses Malanga's concern about that issue, immediately thereafter, the government asked Mr. Newell, who was on the stand, whether he recalled any discussion about providing an explanation to the grand jury specifically, and he said, "I honestly don't recall that, at least not about the grand jury specifically." Well, how about the government in general? I'm quoting from page 275. Let me see if I can refresh your recollection as to what may have been said about the grand jury at that meeting. "I still don't recall anything about the grand jury specifically." It was only later in his testimony, with regard to a more general question about Edmund Burke, that Newell suggested a discussion about the grand jury, and even that was ambiguous. Even that did not suggest what was said about the grand jury, who said it, how it was brought up. Perhaps Mr. Newell inserted it himself. We have no context for those suggestions. I also wanted to mention the idea that these false documents were going to be presented to the grand jury. Again, no reference anywhere in the tape that any false document was ever going to be presented to the grand jury. Instead, they discussed getting documents to provide to tax advisors. In fact, Mr. Fosnot said on one of the tapes that he was concerned about confidentiality. He said, and I'm quoting from the tape on April 19th, 8:03 a.m., at page 2, this is at Supplemental Appendix 77. They're talking about the tax advisors, and Newell says, "So they've been retained in order to preserve legal privilege that they actually are working for the lawyer." He's referring to the tax accountant. Fosnot says, "I see, great. So there's confidentiality there then." Again, the idea that these kinds of discussions suggest an intent to produce documents to anyone, much less the grand jury specifically, is very far-fetched. And finally, just a comment about the tapes in general. On these tapes, there's discussions about many things. They talk about basketball. They talk about office construction. They talk about their families. They happen to talk about the fact that Mr. Fosnot received a grand jury subpoena. They happen to talk about the fact that he was scheduled to testify and that his testimony was put off. The fact that those kinds of conversations, those kinds of terms, appear in the same tape transcript as a discussion about efforts to evade the investigation by the IRS does not show that in the defendant's mind the two issues were inextricably intertwined. There's simply no evidence of that fact. Once more, a mere agreement to evade investigators is not an action. It's not a sufficient endeavor under the statute. If you look at the Schwartz case, you'll see that three of the policemen involved in that case, after committing acts of police brutality, agreed among themselves to present a false story to investigators. That was not the subject of the charge. That was a conspiracy case, and that agreement was not enough to support a conviction. In fact, even testimony, even statements provided to a federal investigator pursuant to that supposed agreement were not enough to support a conviction under 1503, and that was a conspiracy case. Conspiracy to violate Section 1503. There was never a conspiracy allegation made in this case. This was a case of substantive violation, not a conspiracy violation.
Let me briefly ask you about the closing argument. Do you recall the government's argument with regard to the that count?
Your Honor, I was not at the trial. It's my understanding that this was a tax evasion case from start to finish. This was a throw-in sort of count. This was not the focus of a great deal of attention by anyone at the trial court.
Transcript. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.